morning, and welcome to HR Tech Weekly, One Step Closer with Stacey Harris and John Sumser. Good morning, Stacey. How's life in North Carolina?
I'm good, John. We have a beautiful sunshine today, crisp weather. Can't ask for more. It's definitely spring. The birds are chirping, so all good things today.
Yeah, I can hear the birds chirping from here. Are you out in your aviary?
I am not, but I am right next to my window here where they sit and they like to congregate and say, na-na-na-na-na, you're inside working on a computer while they're flying around. So
That's great. So we've got birds in the audience today.
That's right, yep.
So what's in the mailbag for today, Stacey?
It's a bit of a quiet week, I guess you could say quiet week. It's always an understatement, right? But we know that there's a lot of stuff going on the political front that's probably going to have an impact in the HR tech space with the H-1B visas as well as the healthcare. But I think some of it is still up in the air, so we've decided we're going to push that maybe to the next couple of shows if we get some more answers around how that might affect the HR tech space. So we also wanted to cover, I think, some of the other things that have been happening over the last couple of weeks that we haven't had a chance to talk about. One is that Sage announced their agreement to acquire FairSouth. There's some good conversation there about what that means for those in the sort of SMB mid-market space from a HR tech perspective. We also have, there is some interesting, I think, regulation requirement news around the fiduciary rule changes that were recently sort of put on hold or sort of were sort of pulled back based off of a recent executive statement that has had an impact on some of the organizations who were prepared to move that forward. And so we'll talk a little bit about those fiduciary rule changes and what that actually might have an impact on HR tech and the dollars in HR tech. For those who follow the Salesforce space, there was a pretty big announcement recently at their recent collaboration event that they're connecting or collaborating with IBM Watson. So Salesforce Einstein meets IBM Watson. Not quite sure what Watson and Einstein are going to look like together. That should be an interesting picture. So we can talk a little bit about that. Some more on this, you know, just past the International Women's Day, it's hard to fathom that we're still having some of these stories, but Sterling Jewelers got another suit cast against them for wide policies that hurt women, particularly in the sexual harassment and their hotline tips that they put forward. And so we can talk a little bit about how that sort of, again, organizations not realizing that what they do is now open to the market, very transparent, and how that affects their brand and their employees. And then if we have some time today, you know, we had another outage of a large major cloud solution, Microsoft this time, and what that did to the market. And we have my favorite topic yet today, which is researchers that can correct robot mistakes with their minds. If we can get to that topic, I'd have fun today. And then the one me and you were talking quite a bit about, which is Google getting caught once again spreading fake news over the weekend. Is that an issue? Should Google be spreading fake news? What is their job to do? Are they our local library? We don't know that question. So lots to cover, John. Where do you want to start on the conversation?
Oh, I want to go right to your sweet spot. Let's talk about correcting robot mistakes with your mind.
You want to start me off with a smile this morning? Yeah, I thought this was great. It's all research stuff, right? So, but it was. I've been following the story for quite some time because here's my thing about anything that has to do with technology and robots and all this stuff. If I have to enter it into a computer, it's not automated. It's very frustrating, right? So every time I have to work with Siri, every time I have to work with anything, I get very frustrated. She never understands my voice very well. Maybe I talk too fast, who knows? But I really get frustrated the whole thing. So when they started talking about some of the universities doing experiments at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and Boston University, we're working together to create basically a feedback system, which allows someone who's wearing this beautiful headgear that kind of looks like a little octopus, you know, all over your head, who can just think about something being wrong when a robot's doing it, and the robot will get that signal and they will learn that they should no longer do that. Technical thing.
This means that you can guilt trip your robot in the same way that you can guilt trip your children. Yes?
Yes, exactly. And my kids would understand that completely because they know exactly the look when they are doing something I don't approve of.
Right. So this is, you know, what's really interesting about this time in technology and politics is the possibilities are so great and so exciting, and the reality is not quite so much. So at the same time, we're imagining how to run the world by thinking about it. Microsoft is failing to keep their authentication system up and running. And last week, a typo caused the East Coast American internet to crash when somebody entered a silly mistake into a silly screen and brought down Amazon. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah. And so it gets this sort of steampunk feel to it, where you have these extraordinary possibilities lashed to what feels like deteriorating infrastructure.
You know, and I know steampunk is a great sort of way to sort of characterize it, because it's very true. You should have got this, what could be the most amazing things that we could see in our market, you know, coming to fruition over the next, probably 10 years, maybe even sooner, 5 years, right? And yet, you're right, the infrastructure we haven't really sort of invested in, we haven't really set it up in a way to sort of handle human error, human, you know, investment, and the amount of traffic that we're going to be putting onto these systems, right? I mean, the Microsoft authentication issue, I was one of the many people who was trying to log into Skype that morning thinking, oh, it's me and my internet, right? Microsoft never put any commentary out about it, but it was pretty widely sort of talked about on the Twitter feed and across the, they put a couple comments about, yes, we know there are people having some problems, but they never said what happened. And that's the other question is, you know, how much are the vendors held accountable to, you know, sort of the audience that they sort of now basically, you know, hold in their hands for getting work done, right? If you can't get into Microsoft, can you get your job done in some cases? So.
Wow, maybe we'll have next year on the first or second Thursday of March, International Microsoft Workers Day.
I'm hoping that's not the case. But we might have International Google Workers Day, right? So I mean, it goes along with the Google issue, right? So there was a big thing over the weekend about Google. A couple of organizations had once again sort of tried to sort of fool Google into sort of doing some things. So there was, you know, particularly the question was, is Barack Obama planning a coup? And the answer, according to Google over the weekend, would have been yes, because they had a bunch of fake news stuff that was once again popping up in their feeds, but also because that fake news had been paid for, and then they were actually adding advertising to it, which made it seem even more legit, right? And so a lot of the chatter recently has been about, you know, how do we manage the fake news issue going on in the market today? And more importantly, I think of this is that, you know, I can tell you my kids, they don't really think twice about going to Google as their source of information. They type it in and they look at it. That becomes their source of information. And I'd say it's probably pretty realistic for most of the people in the market these days. How much should Google be held accountable to that? And I think it's more of a like a learning or an LMS issue. It's contextualization. Learning content has never been able to be categorized and contextualized very effectively. That's why LMSs have struggled for many, many years to keep up their catalogs. I think Google's somewhat having the same issue if they want to be held to higher standards than we're just a marketing machine.
So can you talk about that a little bit more, the idea that LMSs have a problem categorizing contextual information? Give me another paragraph about that. What does that mean?
So one of the challenges for the longest time, and if you were in the learning space, was truly keeping up with the content, right? Initially in the first couple of years, you would put in an LMS, you would catalog it, you would categorize it alphabetically, you would put it in with maybe some meta tags that said, okay, this content was associated with this kind of things. But as the system grew and as you worked with the larger and larger organizations, that content became just simply unmanageable. So we came up with all kinds of ways to try and sort of categorize things more easily, right? We had learning content management systems. We created these learning algorithms that would sort of self-categorize. We would create, you know, tools where the population could categorize the content, but it's still, you never quite was able to get, you know, to the point where people could get exactly what they wanted or needed at the point in time in which they needed it oftentimes. And that has generally been the learning management system's biggest challenge, you know, since its inception, you know, in the early 1980s. And so I think that this is a situation where Google's getting the very similar thing. People are starting to depend on it like they would their library, like they would their, you know, everyday news source. And because of that, they're being called to sort of the same level of expectation as you would any other learning system, right?
Well, that's interesting. I think I probably would say some of that differently. Google positioned itself initially as a better and more reliable source of information.
Yeah.
And what happened to Google is kind of predictable because they're an advertising company that sells the ability to get traffic and attention. Basically, you can buy your way into Google's results. And there's a bunch of different ways to do that, but the people whose results are on the top of the list are always the people who had the most money to pay for it. So you see more commercial information and less research information because commercial operations have marketing departments. Once that became clear, then it became possible to imagine news that you paid for people to read like you pay for advertising. So I don't know if it's fake news, but it's certainly the view of somebody who has the money to pay you to look at it. And I don't know what that means. It's like the LMS problem, but it's like 10x the LMS problem.
It is. Yeah, exactly. It's definitely much bigger, but it's I think along the same lines, because I don't think we can discount the fact that Google is seen as a primary learning source for us as an organization. So.
Oh, that's great. So it's like a for-profit charter school, only really big.
Staying away from politics. You are bound and determined to drag us into that this morning, aren't you, Jeff?
I am not, but that doesn't mean
right.
I want to steer away from the truth, you know?
No, yeah, it's very, very true. Yeah, and that I think is the challenge is that we have to make some decisions. People who do research, those of us who do research, as well as just informed citizens across the market as to how much are we going to hold Google accountable? How much are we going to hold ourselves accountable? And that makes a real business case on some level for, I think, a lot of the recent sort of learning technology that's out in the market, that basically saying, look, we're going to provide a way for you to do a better way of curating information because you can't have your employees going straight to Google to get the content because this is what happens. And they're quite right on some level with that. So.
But then doesn't that mean this is where we really need a good story to tell about what's going on in the world we live in? Because the moment you say you can't use Google, you can't depend on Google, you need to depend on this other source. You've perpetuated the problem, right?
Yeah.
Right now. Yeah. Now the employer is picking which truth you need to pay attention to. And that's great. That's great that gets you standards and that sort of stuff. But it is even more amenable to the kind of bad judgment that you see coming out of the fake news stuff on Google. So I don't think we have a good way of correcting this yet.
No, I don't think we do. Although I will have to say that, you know, if I'm in a healthcare industry, I would definitely rather have people sort of looking at, you know, how to handle, you know, sort of infectious disease, you know, issues through my personal learning site versus, or my company's learning site, right, versus on the YouTube environment. And I think that's, you know, at least on the compliance side, definitely an area where people are erring on the side of let's put it inside the company, and we'll continue to, hopefully, for a while. So
I want to take a moment here and trot out something that's going to be new. You're going to be hearing more about this as we go along. Our show today is sponsored by Moovola, the leading communication and execution platform that introduces accountability to the workplace to boost productivity and engagement so your teams work smarter, not harder. You can learn more about how you can experience a smarter way to engage at Moovila.com. That's Moovila.com. We're happy to have them as sponsors.
So back, John,
go ahead.
I was just going to say back to sort of the topics of the day this week. We also, I think, you know, this goes along a little bit with this fiduciary role. I think it's worth having a mention about what's happening there. This isn't quite, you know, fake news by any means, but it is this idea of where do you get your regulations? How do you make decisions about what you invest in, right? A lot of that has often been made, you know, sort of relevant based off of what you know is coming down the road from a regulations perspective, right? And we are in an environment where a lot of that is changing. And so that's having an impact on at least HR technology decisions that are happening across the market, both inside organizations where they're making buying decisions, but also externally on the vendor side in which they're, you know, the areas they're investing in. This is particularly the Department of Labor really was rolling out some big changes on sort of retirement plan investment advisors and what they could and could not do in organizations, particularly, you know, whether or not they need to disclose conflicts of interest and anything they were sharing with their clients, and particularly around recommendations that they were making around products and making sure those recommendations would not be harmful to their clients. This seems like sort of a common sense, you know, idea, but there are a lot of, I think, under the covers regulatory issues that are challenging to many of the financial organizations that have caused a lot of organizations to, you know, sort of push back against this. The Department of Labor rule was previously set to take effect on April 10th. It was delayed for 60 days for review by the executive orders by the president. And then now, you know, while we're sort of dealing with what's sort of next on that list, we know that organizations like Fidelity Investment had started to inform customers that they would conduct business as a legal fiduciary under those rules. SAP, which also added a fiduciary role compliance module to its SuccessFactors human capital management system, had also invested in this. And we know several other sort of benefits and retirement organizations have started to invest in this as well. Do you think, you know, some of the vendors, I mean, you've mentioned this before, some of the vendors are just pushing ahead anyways with some of this stuff, even though it might change a little bit, their idea is to sort of err on the side of the stronger regulations, I would say is a better way to put it, right?
You know, what's crazy here is because of the language and because of the subject, this almost doesn't sound like an important thing. Here's what we're talking about. It's possible to be a crook and get invited into a company to help people figure out what to do with their investment in their retirement fund, right? and so this rule that they're talking about is the requirement that the people who advise on those investments adequately disclose if they're telling you to invest in their brother's company, or if they're telling you to invest in something because they've got a short position on it and they want to win that day, right? It's asking the people who are investment advisors to play with the ethics of standard investment advisors. And the idea that you should wait for decisions from the Department of Labor to adequately protect your employees from people who are trying to fleece them seems like patent nonsense to me. There's a very clear positive, oh, we need to do this. If we're going to be in the business of having our people take care of their own retirement with a 401k, then we need to be sure that what we do with them is beyond reproach. I don't understand the thinking of a company that would be dragging its feet in this area.
Well, on the surface, I think you're right. It sounds very much, and in general, I think, you know, everyone would agree with us on this one. But I do think that the challenge is that in some cases, and this is, and again, this comes back to sort of how hard it is to understand what happens on the financial level, is that in some cases, many of these advisors are working with very large, multiple level types of accounts. And sometimes they may or may not have sort of the ability to share in a way that makes sense, you know, as I've sort of been explained to me, all the different sort of connections between those funds that they're sort of recommending from a retirement perspective. But that's part of what you're seeing here with the Fidelity and the SAP Success Factors modules, is easier ways to make it more transparent. Because I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm probably similar to most people who, you know, do my retirement investment. They give me the name of these funds and their, you know, mutual funds and non-mutual funds and various versions of things. And that stuff sort of goes over my head, right? And I think it goes over most people's head. And that's what they're saying, is they're giving a way for that to be, the market to be more educated and the process to be more transparent through the technology and through the tools you're using to make these decisions. It's a good thing on both, on all fronts, but and it's being driven by the regulation. But you're right, it probably should have been done long before it, right?
Yeah, I think the catch thing here is Fidelity, and we should probably think about this. A lot of categories are changing as we're trying to talk about them. Fidelity now defines itself as a technology company. Mm-hmm. And for as long as I've known about Fidelity, it was a financial services company. And so the story here is that Fidelity is moving to fully comply with the fiduciary rule, partly because it's trying to define itself away from being a financial services company. And what that means is that they're trying to avoid the dodginess that most financial services companies engage in when they, you know, financial services companies are companies like Wells Fargo, the generator of 2 million fake accounts so that people could make their bonuses. And this fiduciary responsibility management thing is, oh yeah, we're not going to make our money that way anymore. We're going to make our money on the service that we provide.
Right.
And so this is a landmark change for those companies, I think. And Fidelity is going to set the pattern and compete as a tech company rather than as a finance company.
And I think we're seeing similar conversations with the benefits organizations as well, right? And I think you could have said that, you know, on some level we saw that shift with talent management, you know, 10 years ago when it started to come out, right? So it's not, I think, a new thing in the HR tech space, but it definitely, I think, feels new when you start adding it to big financial organizations, right? Everybody kind of scratches
right.
their head and goes, oh. Yeah.
Right. And you're starting to see, I think we should probably pick this up as a thread in our conversation. It looks to me like what we're witnessing is a decline in the effectiveness of the nation state and an increase in the effectiveness of corporations as governing organizations. Right. In this conversation alone, we talked about organizations' fiduciary responsibility, the likelihood that they'll be picking their version of truth for their employees to read and digest. And you go on and on and on, and it starts to sound like corporations are becoming these global entities that have powers that are similar to nations.
Well, it's definitely been, I think, a theme that we've heard as a as a broader sort of technology conversation, right? As these organizations gather more and more data and have more and more influence with that data, and they become larger and larger outside of, you know, monopolies that have been broken up over the years, it very well stands to reason that they oftentimes have to think beyond a single nation's sort of regulations and think about every nation's regulations and how do they manage across it, right? So a good example here is Sage and their acquisition of Faircell, right? Sage is a very large sort of mid-market financial organization, and they have sort of been around the space. They're sort of the UK's largest tech company today, right? And they announced that acquisition of Faircell, which is a very small sort of mid-market HR solution that was built off of the Salesforce.com platform, but it's been very, very, so I guess I would say, successful in targeting that Salesforce.com audience who is trying to do sales and wants to sort of add some HR components to it in sort of building out their clientele. And so they've sort of reached about $12 million in revenue over the last several years and about 140,000 users in their business. They're now sort of headquartered or in 20 different countries throughout the market. Sage is a very large organization meeting the needs of mid-market businesses. Adding this to them, you're going to, again, see another player, I think, in the ERP space that's going to have a voice in the HCM space as well.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. What else you got, Stacey?
Well, if we want to keep going on the theme of the businesses sort of becoming the major players in our world, I guess that we can sort of wrap up our conversation today then on another Salesforce topic, which is IBM's Watson meeting Salesforce Einstein. This was a big topic for a lot of people who had sort of, I work with, who have conversations about Salesforce on a daily basis. They were very excited about this idea that Einstein will now have access to the IBM Watson database from an integration perspective to help them basically jumpstart Salesforce's sort of artificial intelligence tool with the data they need to be able to make better recommendations and insights on the Salesforce platform and through the Salesforce model. It's a partnership and integration. Watson's been sort of integrated with a lot of other applications over the years. But they will, it seems like IBM's going to share its weather updates and insights on Salesforce App Exchange. IBM's going to share consulting services, it looks like, a lot around IBM Watson and Salesforce Einstein capabilities combined together. And they are going to integrate IBM Watson's application programming interface into Salesforce's predictive insights tool and be able to pull in a lot of unstructured data through the Salesforce model. So there's two organizations that have a lot of data. Do you think they're going to take over the world, John?
Well, so let me spit back to you what you just said. Mm-hmm. So as the result of Einstein and Watson getting together, you're going to be able to get weather forecasts on Salesforce.com.
That's one of things, yes.
Well, the rest of it is we're going to have an API, so there's nothing there, right? There might be something there if somebody figures out what to do with it, but having an API is just an opportunity to bill somebody. It's not a product, right? And having access to all of the data and insights also isn't a product. The only tangible thing that comes out of this partnership is a weather forecast. it's the same thing that we've been talking about where the possibilities are enormous and the reality is dismal. And eventually people are going to get tired of being sold this fantastic future only to discover that it's 20 years away. And want something actual, real to happen now. And I believe that what we're seeing is that there's a lot of posturing because there's not really anything interesting happening right now.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. And part of this, I guess, comes on the heels of IBM getting recent news that the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center had canceled the project, the Watson for Cancer project, because they discovered through their audit that they had spending issues and an unfocused strategy that didn't meet goals. I'm not quite sure how.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
No.
A university canceled an IBM contract because of spending issues.
but the unfocused strategy is even better. Yeah. So I think, you know, like you said, there's all this sort of opportunity looking for for a real output, and it's just not coming to fruition in many cases because we just haven't figured out how to really leverage it yet, right?
So I had, I'll wrap it up with this. I had a great conversation yesterday on the HR Examiner radio show with Ben Waber, who is the CEO of a company called Humanize and a scientist in residence at MIT's Media Lab. And what Ben does is he takes real-time sensor data in workplaces to understand how organizations work and then uses that data to make them better. But he'll be the first to admit that it's the earliest of days and what we're doing are making little tiny incremental bits of progress. And that's what's going on everywhere. It's really, if you were to look back at this time, it's really wonderful to see the amount of progress that we're making, but it simply doesn't live up to the hype that the marketing departments are trying to wrap around it.
Yeah, I agree. And so
you might keep your eyes open. There's an Eric Schmidt speech that he gave at a Google conference today or yesterday where he says big data is like oil and that countries are going to go to war over the ownership of big data in the future.
And on that note, thanks for listening.
Thanks for doing this, Stacey. And thanks everybody for tuning in. You've been listening to HR Tech Weekly, One Step Closer with Stacey Harris and John Sumpter. Have a great day. Bye-bye now.
Thanks everyone. Bye.